time to think bigger.
Elias Pettersson scores!
And think bolder.
Matthew Tkachuk, what a goal!
This is Rintoul and Sermon.
Another chance, great save by Markstrom.
Here is shot, rebound, great save by Dimko.
On the Sportsnet Radio Network.
What's going on? How's your Tuesday? They're playing a pretty big soccer match overseas. The Lions and the Stamps and the Elks and the Bombers and every team in the Canadian Football League is getting their schedule out right now. We got hockey to discuss. I'm Scott Rintoul. She is Karen Sermon. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Scott. Sports are going crazy right now. A little disappointed I didn't get my 6 a.m. soccer match today, but that's okay. We've got Hungary Portugal on the television, so we'll keep our listeners up to date on that. How are you doing today? Happy Tuesday.
Yeah, happy Tuesday as well. I'm well. There's a lot going on around sports, and we've got a show that reflects that as well. Our guest list is extremely diverse. We're going to hit a bunch of different things. Mike McKenna is first up, so probably we start there. Montreal got the start it wanted, except for one key thing. Just didn't get that first goal last night. We all wondered the same thing, didn't we? What's it going to be? First time in front of a crowd in over a year, and it's the Vegas crowd, and it's crazy, and this is a really good team, and they're traveling to the U.S. for the first time. Montreal looked great from the opening puck drop.
Yeah, it's funny how 18,000 fans got pretty quiet pretty quick there in Vegas, but they look good for the start. Like, they had Vegas back on their heels. They were pressing. They got Marc-Andre Fleury a little flutter. They got pucks net. The only thing they couldn't do was score. And unfortunately, as soon as Vegas was finally got one in the back of the net, the tides turned. And I think that's kind of the series we're probably looking at after that first goal. And we'll get more into the game. But I thought Montreal had a great game plan, got the crowd out of it. But once again, they got that goal. And then Vegas just showed up in spades.
Habs 8-0 this postseason when they score first, 0-4 when they do not. Montreal has not overcome a deficit of any kind so far in the playoffs. Playing from in front would seem to be a fairly key ingredient. The other part of it, the way that Montreal is built, I think if anybody looked at this series and said, okay, depth-wise, with all due respect to the way Montreal's built its team, forward group depth favors the Vegas Golden Knights. I think we would all agree. Now, can you win on the blue line? Can you win in net? And there's a case to be made that, no, you can't win on the blue line. In net, you kind of feel like you got to win that one. Carey Price was really good last night at times, and yet I feel like Marc-Andre Fleury was the better goalie. He wasn't the busier goalie, but there's no goal that Fleury allowed, and obviously he allowed just one where you go, that wasn't great. The last goal that Price allowed, the Holden goal, he's overthinking that. They're not coming back at that point anyway, so I guess you can give them a pass if you want to there.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure what to think about the first goal. Now, the first goal is a blast that he doesn't see because he looks around the defenseman on the left side instead of looking where Theodore was shooting the puck from. Is that on Price? Is that on not clear in the front of the net? I'm not sure, but we've got Mike McKenna joining us at the bottom of the hour.
Hey, what I thought I saw last night, Scott, from both goaltenders. One, Marc-Andre Fleury was good early. He kept Vegas in it when Montreal was pressing early, got a few chances. Of course, Brendan Gallagher, Philip Deneau got in his grill. But I thought that was a key start for Vegas when Montreal came out with that energy. You know what, Carey Price, and we could talk about the goals. And hey, how about that Alex Martinez goal? I mean, he had no chance on that because Shea Theodore had probably one of the sickest fakes that I have ever seen. Like, it was legit. Like, I thought he was going to shoot the puck.
And Theodore then all thought he was going to shoot the puck.
I know.
He did. He said after the game, and I'm not sure if you heard this, Karen. He said after the game, I was going to shoot the puck, but he was yelling really, really loud, so I figured I better get it over to him.
But it's like, Carey Price was really good, and yet, because it could have been 6 or 7. One in that game, right? Like, and I think that's the concern, is that Carey Price can still play a really good game, and this is the outcome that we could see for Montreal just because they may be lacking depth. Hey, we ran a poll yesterday, Scott, in our game, in our show, sorry. You know, win the series for Montreal, show well in the series for Montreal, or get rolled by Vegas. 44.1% said show well in this series. That's, I think, where you and I were. Actually, you were, they could win this series. Actually, you're on record as saying that.
Sure.
But I think the concern that I saw last night is once Vegas gets a lead and if Montreal gets behind in the series, they're just not built to come back. And we saw that against Toronto. We saw how much better they played when they can roll four lines, when they have a lead in all those games they won against Toronto in games 5, 6, and 7 and all the games they led and won against Winnipeg. So that's my concern. Show well in the series. I mean, they played pretty well yesterday. But is it going to be enough to play pretty well against a team? No, you're going to probably have to play a perfect game, perfect series to beat this Vegas team.
Down 1-0 after the first period. Pretty easy to go to that dressing room and say, we're okay. We're fine here. One shot beat Price, but we're right in this. They started to take penalties. And they took three consecutive, one at the end of the first, one at the start of the second, another shortly thereafter. And while they've been very good at killing penalties, it sapped any life they had at that point in time. It took energy. Vegas got momentum. Vegas never gave any of that momentum back. And the blue line was the big difference last night.
Oh, my goodness.
The contributions offensively for what Vegas did. They've got 37 points now overall from their back end. They got 6 points last night from their blue line as well. And there were some pretty glaring weaknesses on some of the goals from Montreal's blue line. Brett Kulak had a really tough night. The first goal comes from an icing that doesn't need to be. Ben Chiarot rimming it around. Should Caulfield be on the boards? Should Chiarot be a little more careful? He wasn't under as much pressure as you would think in that situation, if that's what you're going to do. They need Jeff Petrie back.
Oh,
they
yeah.
need Jeff Petrie back in a big way, because Jeff Petrie gives them their big four. I don't know what he's capable of right now because of the hand. I don't know. Obviously, if he was capable of more, he would have played in game one. Brett Kulak is playing a little out of his depth right now, and it's pretty tough to see him filling those minutes. I know they're not the most minutes he's played in the playoffs, but on two of the goals, they're not right on Kulak, but he's a big part of why those goals are scored.
Well, and I mean, the chemistry between Edmondson and Petrie all season, Scott, and no offense to Brett Kulak, but you're replacing a guy that at one point this season was talked about in possible Norris conversation in terms of Jeff Petrie. Like, that's how much he means to this Montreal Canadian teams. He logs a ton of minutes. I probably would lean towards he's probably going to play in game two. Like, maybe it was just a one extra precaution. He was skating yesterday with the extras. He's got that special glove. I mean, did you also see Shea Weber? He hurt his hand in that game. Looks like he kind of jammed his fingers, looked in some pain on the bench. So who knows how healthy he is going forward. And if that's the case, I mean, man, oh, man, he'll probably gut it out because he's the captain and he's Shea Weber. But, man, I mean, if they have any sort of more injuries to that blue line, they are in significant trouble.
Yeah, they certainly are. Weber was laboring. To me, even before that, he doesn't look like he's at 100%. People have been talking about that for quite some time. Certainly not a banner game for him last night. Clear advantage for Vegas on the blue line. We got text coming in. I smell sweep. Bye-bye, Habs. Others saying, I'm so glad the Habs got beat. They're not Canada's team. Vegas, baby. Vegas. I know other people feel differently on that. It's not going to be one game, and all of a sudden everybody changes their tone. There's still a path for Montreal here to get out of Vegas with a split. They've seen the other team now. Let's see how they respond in game number two. Better team on the night won the game. Very clear. Montreal needs a couple of other things to go its way, including the health of its blue line, getting Jeff Petrie back, all of those different things. Stop going to the penalty box. You can't go there needlessly. The other thing that stuck out to me about Vegas, Karen, was there was a very clear plan. Don't just take any shot available. Got to get Carey Price moving side to side. Has to be traffic.
Yes.
Don't just
yes.
fire pucks at net. Don't just go shot volume here. Our shot quality needs to be higher. They were able to achieve that throughout the course of the game.
Because wasn't that the issue with Dallas last year in the playoffs? Like, they had a high shot volume, but they were all to the outside. And that's what helped Dallas win that series in 5 games. Look at this, Scott. That Philip Deneau line with Brendan Gallagher and Lehkonen, they kept the Vegas top line in check. And if you're going to say to me, you can keep Mark Stone, Matt Pacioretty, Chandler Stephenson in check, you probably think you're going to get a good chance of winning that game. But it just shows how dominant that blue line is for Vegas, or at least was last night.
Yeah, and the thing about Vegas that we've talked about for a long time, because their depth down the middle is certainly something you can point to as an area of weakness on the team, that's the luxury they have. Okay, what we consider their top line, they're not like the Bruins, where they have one top line that's going to take care of most of the
Very
offense.
True.
Lines 2, 3, sometimes even 4, but more 2 and 3, they're going to contribute. They certainly got that last night. You mentioned the contribution from the back end. It was really large. We'll talk more about this game with Mike McKenna at the bottom of the hour as well. and what this means for the series. I know Mike, just in brief conversation with him, text last night, he said, Montreal hasn't seen anything this big, this fast. They're going to have to be a lot better. They have to work harder than they have to any point of the playoffs if they're going to get back into this.
43 degrees there yesterday. 47 for Thursday's game. Like, and from all I saw, like, the ice looked fine. I don't know if the players complained about it at all, but could you imagine going into Vegas in 47 degrees and how much that they're going to have to work to keep that ice going there? Also, too, I do want to ask Mike McKenna, was he skateboarding with an ice cream after last night's game? Have you seen his Twitter feed? That seems to be what he does. He does his little, he needs to put the music behind it so he can become Twitter famous, like the cranberry juice guy. You know, with
he's
the
been doing well.
Dreams. But yes, it's see what it's like down there in Vegas. That crowd looked fun. They looked jacked up. Montreal, Joel Edmondson after the game said, like, it was really fun. And we miss that kind of stuff. And I do think that maybe going back to Montreal for game three, you might see an uptick in maybe fans allowed in the stadium. Of course, it all comes down to health and safety protocols and all that stuff. I understand that. But I would not be surprised if Montreal and the Habs are working with the government right now going, okay, like you saw that, we maybe need to get a few more people in the stands if we can, safety-wise.
I didn't see any panic from the Montreal Canadiens after the game. I didn't see the deer in the headlights look. You mentioned Edmondson, Price, the like. Deneau that came up to the microphone. Nobody seemed terribly shaken by what happened in Vegas last night, and that's the business-like approach you need to take. We'll get into it more with Mike McKenna at the bottom of the hour. There's not a long list of ex-Vegas Hex head coaches. In fact, there's only one, and he's no longer out of work. Gerard Gallant joined us a week ago after guiding Canada to a world championship gold overseas, and now he's the head coach of the New York Rangers. So he goes from the sizzle of Sin City to the bright lights of Broadway. He was long rumored to be the front runner. This can't be seen as any surprise. Kevin Weeks tried to throw us a bit of a curveball last week when he came on and said, hey, if I'm the Rangers, I am backing up four Brinks trucks to Rod Brindamore's door and saying, what's it going to take? We'll get more on that in a second. It's not the hefty payday we've seen coaches get in recent years, but Gallant gets a nice contract, 4 years, $3.5 million per. That works out to $14 million over four.
Yeah, that's. I think any of us would like that deal, Scott, in terms of getting hired for a new job. They're already, of course, paying
David
Quinn.
His name
escapes me. David Quinn to not be there. So $3.5 million per year sounds pretty good. It's pretty good for a guy that goes to Vegas, goes to the Stanley Cup Finals first year, wins the Jack Adams Trophy. Then, you know, they get off to a slow start a couple years later, and he's replaced by Pete DeBoer. Goes to now, yeah, like you said, the Big Apple, Concrete Jungle. Not bad for a guy who got put in a cab unceremoniously after one game and got shipped out of Florida. But I like the hire. You saw what he did with Vegas, a bunch of, shall we call, misfits. You saw what he did with, again, a similar team in Team Canada. You know, not the high star power, but got the guys to buy in once Andrew Mangiapane joined the team. And I think that's kind of like the coach that they want there. He needs a guy that's a good communicator, a guy that can get them all to buy into the system, not an X's and O guys, but a guy with a young team who they just need to figure out a way to, I guess, put it all together. And I think they feel, obviously, he's the guy to do that.
Yep, he certainly is. And while Kevin Weeks suggested Rod Brindamore, and there's a lot of teams that would love to have Rod Brindamore, let's get the latest on the Brindamore situation. Elliot Friedman has been all over this. The 31 Thoughts podcast dropped, latest edition this morning. Here's Elliot's latest intel on what's going on with Brindamore, who at this point right now, as we speak, Karen, remains unsigned in Carolina beyond this season.
See, I think they're going to work it out. One of the reasons I didn't get the blog done on Monday, well, first of all, because new information kept on coming in, but two is, Jeff, I'm parsing over every word because this is the time of the year you end up on Old Takes Exposed because you say something that turns out to be terribly wrong.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Wonderful. So I think he's going back to Carolina. I think they're working this out. It sounds like Brindamore and almost all of his staff are working it out. Nothing is done until it's done, but I hear it's headed in that direction. The one exception right now is Dean Chenoweth.
Yep.
Chenoweth does their penalty kill and defensive coach. You know, from what I understand, him and Tom Dundon were talking. Chenoweth said that he wanted to stay, but he felt that he was not near where a coach of his position would be ranking in salary. I don't think he was asking to be the top paid such assistant. I think he wanted to get into line with some other positions. Tom Dundon feels that, you know what, there's a line he's not willing to go past. And I think you're seeing it with Dougie Hamilton too. He just said, look, if you feel you can get that somewhere else, more power to you, but I'm not doing that here. So the word that I'd heard was it looked like it was going to work out with Brenda Moore in Carolina, and maybe Chenault might be the only coach who doesn't return, but nothing's done until it's done.
Yeah, nothing's done until it's done. And there's a bunch of stuff there. It's how much Dundon's willing to pay for coaches relative to other people in the league, be it his head coach, be it his assistant. Rod Brindamore, we've known this for quite some time, Karen, to stay in Carolina, he doesn't need top dollar. He could command top dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Rod Brindamore sees Gerard Gallant get $3.5 million per year. And while he hasn't guided a team to a Stanley Cup final, he has certainly reshaped the culture with that hockey team and the expectation for that hockey team. Something in that range, something beyond that, if you wanted, in terms of currency, he could ask for. Kevin Weeks said, I think the guy's leaving $3 million per year on the table from other situations. But for Brindamore, who made a lot of money in his career, it's not just about that.
No, and I mean, yes, the Rangers, you have to think that they would have significantly paid for Rod Brindamore. Seattle. Like, I keep going back to Seattle, who doesn't have a head coach right now, and I thought Gerard Gallant would have been tops on their list, and they would have had him locked up a long time ago, but maybe they're waiting to see what was shaking down after this season. Like, you have to think they'd open the Brinks trap for Rod Brindamore concerning what he's done in Carolina. But as you mentioned, it's not about the money. He's made his money in his career. For him, it's about a situation where he wants to be. He's beloved in Carolina. He loves that team. He's brought them up. He just wants to see his guys get paid. It does concern me that we're still, what's the date now? It's June 15th. I should know this date. It doesn't have a contract still. Like, it's still not on the dotted line. And like Elliot said, think is the word that he used. Again, leaning towards he is going to re-sign there. But, I mean, something I suppose could go south and he could become a free agent. Tom Dundon seems to drive a hard bargain in terms of what he's willing to pay. So until it's done, I won't believe it fully. But it's just curious to me that this is one of the names that's still kind of out there in the ether just because of the fact that it has not signed on the dotted line.
There are three current openings in the National Hockey League, and one appears far more attractive if Brindamore were to leave than the others, at least to my vantage point. There's Arizona, there's Buffalo, and there's the one you mentioned, Seattle. That's the most attractive one. Like, you can make links to the other organizations if you want. You can make the Kevin Adams link. Hey, Carolina guy, he knows this guy. Sure, but are you going to Buffalo and trying to restart that? They need a culture reset. Absolutely, and this is what Rod Brindamore specializes in. But Seattle gets to set the culture from ground zero. He knows Ron Francis. The checkbook's open. Blank slate as far as cap space goes. Maybe Dougie Hamilton joins him in Seattle. As Elliot said, odds on, he's back in Carolina. That seems to be where this is heading. But if he were to leave, Seattle's got to be at the top of the list, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's a big splash that I think you'd want to make in Seattle, right? Like, I'm very curious to see who ends up going there. Like, I know Rick Tocchet has interviewed there, I believe.
He has, yep.
He interviewed in a couple different places, Buffalo being one of them as well. I mean, but is he a big name? Yeah, he's a known in the NHL circles, but is he the guy that you want to trot out in terms of being the first coach in your franchise? I mean, I heard the 650 Morning Show talking about this, Scott, and in olden days in a franchise, when a new franchise came in, you'd think a Rick Tocchet would kind of be the perfect fit in terms of style of play for an expansion franchise. Hard-checking, defensive style, because the talent just isn't there. But I think Vegas set the bar now for what Seattle may hope to do, and Gallant obviously set the bar in terms of going to the Stanley Cup Finals. So do you want a checking coach who's going to probably play maybe a quote-unquote boring style hockey when you're trying to get into a new market? I don't know, but it does strike me as curious that they haven't locked up their coach yet.
Well, let's put this out there. And 650, 650, 960, 960, you know the numbers. You can text in at any time. What's the biggest splash Seattle could make? Is it a coach like Rod Brindamore? Wow, what a coup. We took this guy who might win the Jack Adams this year, and we brought him to Seattle. Is it a free agent like Dougie Hamilton? Hey, number one guy on the block. We signed him. Here we go. Here's one of the pillars we build around. The other opportunity is an offer sheet.
I was going to say that.
I don't think it's going to get to that point. But if you want to construct a, hey, here's the biggest splash they could make argument, an offer sheet for a young player, maybe your rival to the north, that might be the way you go. I don't think it happens. I think Elias Pettersson gets his deal done in Vancouver. But if you're talking biggest splash that could happen, this text comes in, Eichel.
Yes.
Hey, yep. Maybe it's Jack Eichel, trade for him, $10 million in the cap. They've got so much cap space, they don't know what to do with it all. Like, what's the biggest splash they could make? Do you think it's a player? Do you think it's a coach?
Ooh, that's a good one. If it's Rod Brind'Amour, I think that's probably the biggest splash because he would be the biggest free agent name out there in terms of coaching hires. If it's a player, does a Dougie Hamilton move the needle? I mean, he's kind of quiet. He likes to go to museums. Is he going to be the face of your franchise? A Jack Eichel, he might be relishing that situation, right? Like, I mean, he was the face of the franchise for a while in Buffalo, but he needs a new change of scenery. Fresh, you can market it. Fresh team, fresh start. Let's go. New city for you. I could see that happening. Offer sheet. I get where you're going there because my first thought was, okay, well, Elias Pettersson is eligible for an offer sheet this summer if the Canucks don't get him locked up before that's possible, but you just don't see it happen. I mean, we did see it with Sebastian Aho in Montreal and Carolina matched that, but I mean, the odds of that happening are just so minimal. So maybe that is the biggest splash if they could do that, but I think even the Canucks would probably match that in terms of keeping him on the roster. So yeah, I just think maybe a Jack Eichel or Rod Brind'Amour, I'd probably put those in the two veins of the biggest splashes that Seattle could make.
This one comes in, the biggest splash they could make would be former Thunderbird Matthew Barzal. Under contract, of course, you got to make that trade. Never say never. Anybody can be traded. I don't see the Islanders doing that, given what they have and given what he represents in that organization.
He could win the cup.
His youth. Sure. Ain't no way Petey is signing the offer sheet. That's a very good point as well. I doubt that Elias Pettersson would do it, but Sebastian Aho signed one last year to get his deal done. So anything can happen. Anything can happen to get a deal done. Sometimes you sign it just because you want your team to be forced to do it, and that seemed to be what the Aho one was all about, for example.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be interesting because I was looking, so the July 21st is the expansion draft, and then we have the draft the 23rd, 24th. So they'd still have some time. But you do want to have to think that they would have these people in place prior to it because you got to go through the drafting with the coach. You got to go through the expansion draft and who's all available for other teams with the head coach, who he's looking for, what style of team he wants. Like, it's not just all what Ron Francis wants. It's got to be in, collusion, but it has to be in cohesion with what the head coach wants as well.
One last thing, one other coaching note to get in. Jeff Ward has found himself a new home today. Not out of work terribly long, the former head coach of the Calgary Flames joins Dallas Eakin's staff down in Anaheim. So he's got a new gig. I think everybody wishes Jeff Ward well. Took over as difficult a situation as you can think of in the National Hockey League with the Bill Peters situation. Got Calgary a qualifying round win that year, got them to a positive record. I think everybody had a lot of time for Jeff Ward. Whether it was working out great or not, good for him. He's got a new gig. We're going to turn our attention back to what happened last night in Vegas. Mike McKenna will join us next. Man, we got plenty to come. By the way, Hungary, Portugal, still 0-0 on the board. 25th minute of play overseas at Euro. We'll keep you apprised of that as the morning continues. Mike McKenna. He saw them on film, he saw them on TV, he saw them in person last night. His first impression of the Habs. Find out next right here on Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
Coaching salaries, offer sheets, does anyone else smell collusion? That's John in Vancouver. I understand what he's getting at there. Hey, see if we can depress the coaching salary market. If we get enough people around the league to do that, then we keep our costs down collectively. Too many teams have already bucked that trend. There are too many teams out there that have said, in my opinion, John, no, we're not on board with that. And this is the one thing that people forget, in my opinion, in the National Hockey League, or some teams don't maximize. I shouldn't say people forget. They all know it exists, Karen. But there are franchises out there who have said, look, we all have to be at $81.5 million for player salaries. But nobody's telling us what we can spend on coaches. Nobody's telling us what we can spend on resources within the organization, player development, all of the different things we use to keep our people. You can spend as much money as you want in that regard. And that is where some of the advantage lies right now in the National Hockey League. Hey, We'll pay our people better. We'll take care of them better. And the reputation gets out that, boy, that's a pretty good place to be. I might want to go there.
True. And it's when you, but when you look at the Carolina situation, it's just a little different one. Like, it's because it's not based on kind of how Tom Dundon runs his operation. It's well known that he's going to buck the trend in terms of what other organizations are going to do, but he's got someone there who wants to be there. And he that culture was based on what Rob Brind'Amour made within that organization, not what Tom Dundon did too. So it's just weird how Carolina's a little different. But again, if you have a head coach who's willing to be there, he's part of that culture, the fabric of Raleigh, you know, because he got brought the cup back to them, or brought the cup to them, not back to them. So it's interesting that way. Looking here at what Seattle can make a splash, Scott, if someone wants to make a splash, Travis Le Courrier says, go after Ryan Nugent Hopkins. He's got ties to the Pacific Northwest. Again, I don't know how big a splash that is.
I really like Nuge. I really like Nuge. That's not a splash.
It's a, okay, he's got ties to Burnaby. You know, you could play the Vancouver, you know, angle with Seattle. I guess that's there. But it's, I mean, on any good cup contending team, and someone's going to text in because they know they always argue with me on this, he's a third line center, right? So is that a big enough splash? Seth Jones was thrown out there. That could be a decent one.
A splash is something that gets everybody's attention in the hockey world. And with all due respect to the Nuge, signing a free agent contract in Seattle is not that. Oh, okay, nice player. Wonder where he fits in there. Certainly a guy culture-wise you want in your organization. All of those different things. Splash means everybody goes, whoa, did you hear what Seattle did? Did you just see what Seattle did? That's a splash. That's what we're talking about. What's the biggest splash Seattle could make? Let's get to Mike McKenna. He joins us every single Tuesday, and he was at the game last night in Vegas. Mike, thank you very much for doing this. How are you?
I'm doing great. Karen, Scott, how are you guys doing today? Good to hear your voices.
Yeah, thank you, Mike, and we're happy to have you on. We're doing quite well, thank you very much. Now, we were not among 18,000-plus at T-Mobile last night like you were. Montreal got that environment for the very first time. Certainly didn't look phased off the hop. Montreal started very strong. What were your first impressions of this Habs team now having seen them live for the first time?
Well, I thought they were just massively excited to get into a building with 18,000 people, skate out for warmups and have showgirls behind the glass. And like, it's just surreal. Think about being in Canada as long as everyone has. I don't have to tell you guys about it. I mean, you know what it's been like. Full lockdown, you're in your hotel, you're at your house, that's it. You go to the rink, you're a hockey cyborg. And then to come to the U.S., even though they're still bubbled up, but to just be part of something live like that, I thought that the Canadians fed off of that energy. And really, for the first 10 minutes, they played a strong game. They were able to carry the pace of play. Marc-Andre Fleury made some saves. But the moment Vegas got a little bit of life, when Shea Theodore scored, it seemed to flip things towards Vegas. It changed the whole dynamic of the game. I thought Montreal was plucky. I thought they played a heavier game than a lot of people seem to expect. For a team that doesn't have a huge amount of size, they play hard. You know, you notice players like Josh Anderson. You notice, you know, how fast Toffoli is. These things that you expect, but seeing it in person is real. It's just as the game wore on, Montreal started to chase. They couldn't keep up with the Vegas rolling four lines, and they ended up sitting the box, which carried it, just crushed all the momentum for the Canadians and put it all in VGK's column.
Now, maybe you disagree with this because Carey Price had more highlight reel saves than Marc-Andre Fleury, but to me, Fleury won the goaltending battle last night, not on volume and maybe not on quality, but he made the saves at the time, and that was early in the hockey game. On Fleury specifically, what aspects of his game has he improved since he arrived in Vegas 4 years ago?
Yeah, well, I think Fleury last night, interestingly enough, and I said this earlier too, that, hey, he played great in the first 10 minutes, which he did. I actually thought Fleury was a little bit out of control during that time, and he had to make more saves than necessary because he was attacking the puck. He wasn't letting it come to him. He had several combination saves where it looked like his energy was so far through the roof that he just couldn't quite contain himself. And the thing is, though, when Marc-Andre Fleury is really vibing, he can do whatever he wants because he sees the puck so well. He's so athletic. He'll make those saves. I think, you know, as the game wore on, he started to be more in control. He started to play more in the paint between his posts. And that's what you saw this season, was a slight coming back into his crease, right? We're talking a 6-inch difference, letting the play come to him, not attacking the rush, using his posts as bumpers more often, just really being in control. And for Marc-Andre, you know, it's not as much stand your ground and get out and hold your angle. It's being able to adjust. It's being able to use his athleticism and his good reads and his patience on his edges. I think there's been improvement this year, but there are times in anybody's game that you revert back to what's always made you successful, for good or bad. And I think we saw a little bit of both of that last night with Marc-Andre Fleury.
Mike, let's talk about the flip side and Carey Price, because he wasn't yawning last night like we've seen him in previous games. But he saw a lot of shots. He was very good. It could have been, I think, 6 or 7 goals for Vegas. But what were your first impressions of seeing Carey Price live this season?
Well, 2 of the 10 Bell saves he made moving laterally, glove save on Mark Stone, and another one later on Jonathan Marchessault, both in the second period, were just world-class saves. Unbelievable. And you could see a little playfulness out of Carey Price, gives a wink to a teammate as they go by, shades of Patrick Waugh in all the old Habs gear. And by the way, Carey Price's equipment, a direct tribute to the old Coho set that Patrick Waugh used to wear, which will drive all the goalie nerds out there crazy, like myself. But, you know, I look at a couple of the goals against, and I look at Theodore's goal, and to me, like, that should have been stopped. Watching Carey abandon space both physically and visually to try to look far side around a moving screen in front of him, I felt like he wasn't prepared off the faceoff for that. I felt like he didn't know where the threat was coming from. You want to stay on the short side if all possible and not abandon space. So I wasn't particularly impressed with that first goal against, and even Alec Martinez's power play goal, but his goal in the second period, where, you know, Shea Theodore's coming right down Broadway. He's tickling the scoreboard with the backswing. It looks like he's going to have a full clapper. Price didn't get his feet set, and he ended up in the white paint, gave the whole side to Alec Martinez. He had to go soccer style. I guess what I'm getting at is I thought that Carey Price was a little bit over aggressive for what he needs to be. I don't think his feet ever need to be in the white ice. And against a team like Vegas that can strike so quickly, he made life difficult on himself at times. But he also countered that with some of those unbelievable saves. So a little bit of a mixed bag from Carey in the first game.
So let's go back to that Theodore goal, the Martinez goal. Do you think that's something Alec Martinez saw in Carey Price because he was calling for it? Because Theodore thought he was going to release a slapper, said after the game, yeah, but Martinez was yelling at me to give me the puck. Do you think it was something that Martinez saw, or just he just knew he had the chance to have an open net?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I think just your player's intuition in that type of scenario is that, hey, if the goaltender gets out and sees that shot cleanly from Theodore, he's got a pretty good chance of making that save, even though he's walking into it from so far away. And if you get a one-timer off, that's absolutely Alec Martinez's honey hole. He's got the knee down one-time clapper from the off wing. He plays it on the power play on occasionally. He's got full confidence in that shot. And the level of intelligence that Alec Martinez plays at, he knows, hey, like, give me the puck in that area, I'm not going to miss. And it's going to be a harder save for Price to make. And Theodore sold it so well, you know, and partially that's because he got the late call on it. But, I mean, that was a pump fake to end all pump fakes, right? And, you know, I've never seen Price go full soccer goalie. So, impressive play from Martinez and Theodore on that. And it just, to me, it's just Martinez being comfortable and wanting the puck in that scenario.
Somebody's getting a pretty good player in Alec Martinez next year, aren't they?
Oh, man. And I think the question for him is, what are you going to get him at? He's making $4 million, which is a value right now. To me, he's a $6 million defenseman, but I don't know what it's going to take. Is it going to take term? Is he going to want 3 or 4 years on a, he's 33. Or 32 or 33, and he's put a lot of hard miles on that body. Would he take a 2-year deal at more money? I don't know. But to me, like, I think he's priority number one for Vegas to get signed for next season once they get done worrying about the task at hand.
Mike McKenna joins us every single Tuesday, Vegas Golden Knights insider, former professional goalie as well. Martinez was part of what was a very big night for Vegas's blue line. It's been very effective at producing points, up to 37 now collectively. Why has it been so effective offensively this postseason?
Well, I think it relates to the defense so much for the Golden Knights. The first series against Minnesota was pretty spread out in the scoring. The big guys came to play. You know, Pacioretty was out for the first 6 games, so there had to be some distribution amongst the team. And you know, in Colorado, that first line for the Golden Knights really had to contain the MacKinnon line for Colorado. So they didn't get the same type of opportunities as they would in this series. But it came from the back end last night. And that's a big difference between the two clubs for me, between Montreal and Vegas, is that there's depth scoring on the back end for Vegas. And late in the Colorado series, it really took over. Alex Pietrangelo came to life. You've got Shea Theodore, Alec Martinez. These guys are all putting up points. But look at last night. 5 of 6 Golden Knights defensemen had a point. Not one of them was minus. And you flip it over to the Habs and not a single point from a defenseman. Now, they only scored one goal on the power play. I understand that. But even the shot totals, they're just not there in that same volume. I think it just speaks to how the Golden Knights generate offense from their defensive zone, getting up the ice, getting opportunities on the rush, and then sustained in zone.
Alex Pietrangelo, 13 shot attempts last night, game high 7 shots, 4 takeaways, 3 block shots. He did take a nice hit from Alexander Romanov early in that first period. I think a little wake you up to the series hit in that one.
But yes,
I just kind of want to give you like the floor to just talk about, like, he is such a stud defenseman, and they could have gone after, I don't know who's available, but I mean, the talk was in the offseason they did need to upgrade at center, but they went for, you know, the stud defenseman and Pietrangelo. Like, he is just, he's so fun to watch out there, Mike.
Well, and he's playing at the peak of his game right now. And, you know, you look at somebody that's always played in one organization. He'd always been in St. Louis. And it takes time to adjust to a new system, a new city, a new everything for your environment. And there were two times this season where Pietrangelo really started to kick it into gear. And both times he was felled by something. He catches COVID. He's out of the lineup. So then he's got to come back from that and get going again. Well, and then he gets injured and he misses a couple of weeks. And then he's got to get back from that and get going again. You started to see the best version of Alex Pietrangelo late in the season. He started to take over games defensively and offensively. And now you're seeing it happen all over again in the playoffs. You're seeing why he was a captain of the St. Louis Blues and led that team to a Stanley Cup, because he can play all over the ice. He's reduced the number of turnovers. He's increased the number of offensive chances that he's been getting. And he's got that streak of nastiness to him, I think, that's a little bit undercover. Like, shades of – I don't want to call this like Chris Pronger, because I don't think anybody ever wants to be slashed by that man again in the NHL. But Pietrangelo's not easy to play against, right? He's strong. He uses his stick. He's got good body positioning. And to me, his game's really been elevated by being paired with Alec Martinez. It's the same thing Martinez did for Shea Theodore. Now you're seeing what Martinez does with Pietrangelo. And again, to your point earlier, Scott, it speaks to how important Martinez is to this lineup, to the back end for the Golden Knights.
If Chris Pronger came back into the NHL right now, how many defensemen in the league currently are actually meaner than Pronger? Are there any?
I don't know the answer to that. There's not many. I mean, like, he was, I mean, I've skated a few times, like, in camps, and like, I was terrified to just be on the ice with the guy, period. You know, and there's just something about you that would make you, he'd make you nervous, because you just knew what he was capable of. And like, that nastiness is, it's an underrated tribute, or underrated tribute. I can't even talk today, guys. I forgot how to speak. It's an underrated attribute, is nastiness. Braden McNabb, look at the way he plays defense. Look at the way Shea Weber plays defense. Those are the types of guys that make you nervous, that you don't want to be on the ice against, because you know you're going to get punished when you're out there.
So Shea Weber is a good talking point here as well, because he hurts his hand last night, but he looked like he was laboring even before that. I agree with you. When he's at the top of his game, that's one of his hallmarks. That wasn't there last night. They certainly missed Jeff Petrie. Brett Kulak got exposed on a couple of goals as well. If you're constructing a path back into this series and potentially to winning this series for Montreal, does it have to include Jeff Petrie in that back end for the Habs?
You hate to say that it has to, but it's hard to believe that without Jeff Petrie, they can truly compete. And that's just reality. I look at how important he is moving the puck, what he can do on the power play alongside the other players that are out there. Like, I didn't have any idea how hard Petrie shot the puck until I played against him a couple of years ago. Like, usually when you do pre-scout, usually when you've played against guys for a long time, you kind of have an idea of everybody in the league. Like, when you play the Caps, you know, okay, Ovechkin can crush it. Carlson can crush it. You're ready for it. And you go to play the Habs and you're ready for Weber, and all of a sudden Petrie blows one off your collarbone and it feels like you got hit by a semi. He's so important to that team. They need him back. I think Johnny Merrill helped them as well, you know, having another steady defenseman. But it's also through their lineup. I don't think that Montreal did enough in the neutral zone to really slow down Vegas, to keep them out of the zone. There were times where, like, frankly, it looked like Montreal just got run ragged in their defensive zone too. And a lot of that was just from miscommunication. And that's not all in the defense. It's on the forwards as well. And they ended up sitting in the box for it, chasing the game. And that played into Vegas's favor.
Totally agree. Felt like a completely different game after those three penalties in particular. Montreal lost any semblance of a momentum it had. Mike McKenna, Tuesday analyst, works with the Vegas Golden Knights, former professional goaltender as well, which means you worked more closely with Gerard Gallant than a lot of people in the hockey world. What are the New York Rangers getting, in your opinion?
Well, you know, I had the pleasure of working alongside Gerard in a couple of scenarios. First, as a player in the Florida Panthers franchise, where he was loved and respected and got so much out of that team the first year, and then was unceremoniously fired, and weird things happened in Florida.
yeah. And then we all remember the cap. We all remember the cap.
Yeah. It was odd. Okay. There were a lot of strange things going on there. I have no shortage of those in my career, but he shows up in Vegas and does a masterful job inspiring, leading, coaching this band of misfits, right? Well, they're all talented hockey players. I think Gerard Gallant has always gotten the most out of his teams regardless of skill level. And to me, that shows you've got somebody who can rally the troops, who can say the right things, but he can also mesh in what's necessary when it comes to the tactical element of it. And I think that his resume is really going to make a difference in New York. You've got somebody with some swag. He's been to a cup final. He's had success. I'm not sure how much the world championship plays into it, like everybody's making right now. I mean, players kind of look at that as a kind of a sideshow in some ways, but without question, he did a good job there. I just think his reputation precedes him. They're getting somebody who's a well-oiled coach who knows exactly what he needs from players up and down the lineup. And I mean, the Rangers have a lot of horses. So I'm hopeful for Gerard. I'm hopeful for the Rangers. I think it's a good fit. And we got to see how it works out. But Gerard can coach, man. We'll see what happens.
And Mike, does he relates well to younger players as well? Because, of course, they're young kids there. Capo Caco getting more out of him. Alexis Lafreniere. You've got Adams Fox, who's still young. Like, is that someone, do you think that's why they went with him? Because he can relate to younger players as well?
He bridges the gap very nicely.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, of course, they had somebody previous there in David Quinn who, you know, could do the same thing. But mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, with Gallant, you definitely have that, like I say, that mixture of having played, having coached, having a reputation. But also the respect level in the locker room. You know, players know that you got to perform for Turk. Like you got to skate, you got to work hard, and people, it's expected of you. But he's also fair in how he treats people. You know, he's the type of guy that, frankly, you'd like to have as your grandpa. You know, and you know, one of my old teammates actually has him as his father-in-law, and I can tell you that he is a great grandpa. But you just need somebody who can handle young kids nowadays, who knows how to work them. And especially like a challenging situation like Vegas was in that first year as an expansion team, I think that showed an awful lot in how he's malleable, how he can alter his approach, how he can get the most out of players.
So it was very odd timing when they dismissed Gerard Gallant and brought in Pete DeBoer. Pretty tough to argue with the results, though. DeBoer takes them to back-to-back conference finals this year, perhaps beyond. I think we all believe Pete DeBoer is a great coach in the NHL, but we're not quite sure why. What's behind his effectiveness?
He's so system-oriented and so detailed. And the ultimate irony of that is the deeper you go into playoffs, the less you have to coach. People don't really like to hear that. They think that the coach needs to walk in and give the big Al Pacino speech and fight for every inch and claw and scratch. And you know what? A lot of that Herb Brooks type stuff really doesn't go on anymore. It's just not how you rally people. How you rally players nowadays is by giving them the game plan, telling them how to win, showing them how to win. You do that in your video work. You do that when you have diligence and practice, when you go out and you accomplish what you need to. And I think that Pete DeBoer, along with Steve Spott, who came in with him, they just have a firm grasp on what's necessary to win. You have to have a great penalty kill in the NHL. You have to have defense in transition. You have to be able to get the puck out of your zone quickly. It's a demanding structure. It takes a bit for players to learn how to do it. But once they grasp it and once they buy into it, it's successful. But it takes work. And I mean, to me, that's really what it comes down to. You've got an ex-lawyer that's a coach, and lawyers are pretty analytical people. They understand the human element, but they understand what's necessary to build up to that point where you can win hockey games. And it comes down to structure, defense, having the puck on your stick.
Well, and you don't have to go give those speeches if you've got the right leadership, which the Golden Knights would appear to have in the room. as far as a letter goes, that's highlighted by Mark Stone. One of the comments of this past week that really struck me was Alex Tuch sitting there after the game, after Stone's overtime winner, and saying, he's the captain we always wanted. We all can see what Mark Stone does on the ice. How does he lead off it?
Well, he's just an awesome dude, you know, and I can say that from playing with him in Ottawa. Like, I come into that locker room, we don't know each other at all, and he's your friend, you know? I mean, of course, he's your teammate and everything, but I think that his just, like, what you see from Mark Stone in games is, it's a really aggrandized version of himself. Like, he can't, when something good happens, when anything emotional happens in a game, it's almost like he can't, like, control himself in a really good way, right? He's not out of control. He's not snapping sticks. He's not yelling at people. It's just he's emotional on the ice, which is awesome. And people feed off of that. But off the ice, you know, in the room, he's actually a pretty soft-spoken guy, but he knows the right moments. And he's not somebody who just talks to hear himself talk, which I guess it's probably what I kind of do for a living now. But regardless of that, he really knows the right moments. His words carry gravity because players trust him. They trust his vision of the game because he plays with such a high hockey IQ that people know what he is seeing and what he's feeling is what you need to follow. And that's why the C is on his chest.
And he looks like he could be the lead singer for Stillwater as we make movie reference here at the end of this right now.
I am a golden god. Is that what it, right? We're talking about?
Yeah,
almost
yeah,
famous here,
almost
right?
Famous. There you go.
That's
there
right.
You go.
One of my wife's favorite movies.
Excellent. I'm glad we could bring that into the picture. Hey, keep those videos up as well. Karen mentioned them before. She's really enjoying the videos you're putting out on the skateboard.
Well, I'm jealous of like the 100 degree heat probably at like 9 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock at night after the game. It's a dry heat though, right? So it's not too bad.
It's dry. It was 109 when I walked in yesterday. So let's go minus 30 divided by 2. We're looking at 40 Celsius about that walking in
so
in a
hot.
Suit. It was toasty.
So
but you know what? It's plenty cool in T-Mobile.
If you're going to talk like that, I'm going to need to wear sunscreen on these hits, man. I'm a ginger, all right? You can't do that to me.
It's fun. I taught one of my friends on the Canadians when they came here, even though they weren't going to be outside, he said he packed a swimsuit and SPF 195, even though they won't be outside.
Yeah, man. As soon as it gets that hot, I just put the sunscreen in the shower head in the morning. Hey, great stuff, Mike. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for doing this. Lots to talk about again next week. I know that. Enjoy the hockey, and we'll do it again soon.
Sounds good. All right. Everybody enjoy your day. Thanks as always.
That is Mike McKenna. Great follow on Twitter as well. You and I both enjoy the videos he's putting out.
Hey, can I just say, like, they always say you go to Phoenix, you go to Arizona, or sorry, anywhere in Arizona, you go to Vegas. It's like, okay, it's a dry heat. It's not too bad. Like, I'm from Winnipeg, you know, people out east from Toronto, you understand when it's even 30 degrees and you add, you know, like a 60%, 70% humidity, it's like walking and hitting a brick wall when you hit that heat out of the airport. But just guess what? When it hits 40 degrees, it's freaking hot no matter what. Like,
I don't
you
know
just how, can't be outside.
I don't know how people go outside. I don't know how people go outside. And I grew up in Kamloops. It gets very hot there. It hits 40 a couple of times each summer. I don't know how people do things in that kind of heat. Like, I'm not built, obviously, if anybody's seen a picture of me, I mentioned the ginger thing. I'm not built for the extreme heat. That's just not how I roll.
See, it's funny. Like, I'm okay for the sun and the heat. Like, I tan. I don't tend to burn. The only time I've burnt is when I went to Hawaii one time because I decided to put on, like, bronzing instead of sunscreen, and that just wasn't a good idea. But we went to Vegas one August, Scott, and it was about 45 degrees every day. Like, just don't go to Vegas in August. And we decided to walk back from, I don't know, 5 blocks outside, not going through the hotels where there's air conditioning, but 5 blocks outside. I think it was still 10 o'clock in the morning, and I was dead. Like, it was so hot.
Well, if we're just going to list all the times that we've been sunburnt, that'll take up the rest of the content on this show. We got about 3 hours worth that I can walk you through right now. It's Rintoul, it's Sermon. Ronaldo, by the way, missed a sitter in the first half. It's 0-0 at the break between Hungary and Portugal. Karen, that's a chance he buries in his sleep most days.
He looked pretty shocked. I saw a tweet out there by one of our colleagues saying Ronaldo always yells at his teammates for missing easy ones. I wonder if he's going to yell at himself. He did look pretty shocked that he didn't hit it. Of course, he's going for the record number of goals in Euro all time. He's tied with Michael Platini at 9. Needs just one more to become the all-time Euro leading scorer.
Well, maybe they're going with the template they used in 2016.
Oh, God, I hope not. Please, no.
They sleptwalked through the opening preliminary round. They barely qualified to get into the elimination stage, and then they went on the run, and they ultimately became champions. 0-0 at the break there. A lot of you like chaos. There is a faction in sports that apparently does not, and it's somewhat disappointing, but I understand it. We'll get to it next on Rintoul and Sermon.
You're listening to Rintoul and Sermon.
Quite often we root for the story in this business, don't we? Like, there's rooting interest and you got your team, but other times you just kind of root for the story because you know it makes for a great conversation. And everyone was rooting for this story, and they're not going to get it. And I understand why, but we all wanted to see it. I'm Scott Rintoul, Karen Sermon as well. It's Rintoul and Sermon. There will not be a Brooks and Bryson pairing at the U.S. Open beginning on Thursday.
Wah, wah, wah. Too bad. They were never going to do it. Do you think Brooks Koepka would have teed off with Bryson DeChambeau? Are you kidding me? Come on. They could still, I suppose, if they're in a pairing in the final two rounds. But yes, Brooks Koepka is not going to tee off with his best friend, his BFF, Bryson DeChambeau. Koepka will be in a trio with Colin Morikawa and Justin Thomas, JTT. I always call him JTT, Jonathan Taylor Thomas. But Justin Thomas, he has forgotten how to play golf, and he is struggling right now. So that'll be interesting to see how that group does. DeChambeau with, of course, Masters winner Hideki Matsuyama and Strafasi, who I don't know very well, and Phil Mickelson. And Scott, have you watched any Golf Channel coverage this week yet? Have you gone to the Golf Channel at all?
I have not. I've spent more of my time on Euro and hockey and hoops. I have not spent much time at the Golf Channel this week.
So, I mean, obviously live from the U.S. Open, they're doing a ton of stuff there. If you want to know about Phil Mickelson, just go to the Golf Channel. Like, it is 100% right now coverage for Phil. Understandable. I completely get it. He's the reigning PGA champion. He did it at 50. He's going to turn 51 tomorrow, so he'd be the oldest to win again. He's never won at the U.S. Open. He's got six runners up there. It's his home course. I get it. He's won five times there, yet he hasn't won since they changed the course back in 2005. But it's kind of like when Tiger is in a tournament. All you get is Tiger news. Well, this tournament is all about Phil Mickelson, and I could totally see this being one of the cases. They invest so much time in him, he doesn't even make the cut.
Boy, would that be terrible in his home state. As you said, his home course, not one that's treated him very well, as you just alluded to in recent years. Like, everybody thinks, oh, it's Torrey Pines. This is a great setup for Phil. Not so much, actually, and there's lots of information out there as to why this is not a great setup for Phil to get the one prize that has always eluded him. He's made no bones about the fact that he's wanted it forever more than any other. I don't know how many of his majors he would trade to have one U.S. Open. It'd be an interesting question to ask him. I don't know if he'd give you an honest answer, but he would trade multiple, in my opinion, multiple major championships to have one U.S. Open, to get that thing done at Wingfoot. Back to the original premise, I know why they didn't pair Bryson and Brooks.
Yes, sorry. Yeah.
It's because of everything that would have happened with the gallery. The drama between the two, they would have been able to handle. If this is happening a year ago and there are no spectators, I could see it. I really could. But you saw recent tournaments. You saw DeChambeau losing it because fans are yelling Brooksy at him and they're having all that different fun. To me, it's more about fan behavior than it is about the two of them. Whatever. They have beef with each other. They have a beef with each other. Don't talk. Who cares? Tee off. Beat the other guy. Maybe it fuels you. It's almost as though if they paired those two, they'd be encouraging detrimental fan behavior along the way.
And it's not fair to the third person who would probably be in that group as well, right? Like, I mean, you put someone in there that's maybe not mentally as strong, and to hear what that's going to be said, I hadn't thought of it that way. That's a very good point, because of the fact that we saw what happened at the PGA Championship and how out of control the fan base got there for Phil. I think that was maybe an isolated incident, and that would never happen again. But yeah, could you imagine being at the tee box or anytime a guy's trying to hit a shot and the guy holding up that yellow be quiet sign? You think like guys are going to be quiet for Bryson? Because obviously they're going to be on Brooks' side. We're all on Brooks' side, right? Bryson's going to be the evil guy, and Brooks is going to be the good one no matter what he says. It's just, that's how it's going to be, I think. I think he's the villain. Like, Bryson is the villain in this situation.
He is, and it makes it interesting because I don't think Brooks Koepka was this great fan favorite prior to this.
No,
there were
all.
A lot of people who were not big Brooks Koepka guys or fans of any kind. They didn't like his demeanor. They thought he was a little too aloof, and they thought he was a little too much about him. But Bryson DeChambeau has actually kind of made him look good in all of this.
It's very true, because what was Brooks' thing? It's like, okay, he uses tournaments just to prepare for majors. And when he speaks to the media, he's kind of like Tiger and Phil were back in the day, right? This kind of confidence, not wanting to give too much up about himself. And they've obviously mellowed in with experiences and with age, and we know that. But yeah, it's funny how all of a sudden Brooks Koepka has become the kind of good guy in this situation. I still, like, it still could happen. I mean, both of them are probably betting favorites, right? We could see it Saturday. We could see it Sunday. It'd be interesting if that was the final pairing on Sunday. I think if it's not Phil Mickelson, I think the PGA would really love to have Koepka and DeChambeau in that final pairing going down the stretch at Torrey Pines.
Sure. And if they play themselves into that, there's nothing you can do. You go, hey, they played themselves into a spot where they're paired together. Everybody knows the rules. These guys have played really well. That's why they're paired together, and that happens. Mm-hmm. But when you have the control and you put it there, to me, you're encouraging probably what they don't want. They really don't. As much as they like the PR that comes from the public beef, they don't want the smoke that happens on. Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
It's the PGA, though.
Yes, they do.
It's the PGA. They don't like to have anything to, I mean, they're pretty just like, we're the gentleman's game.
They still want attention. They still want attention. If they could get attention in a different manner, I'm sure they would take it. But this is what a lot of people are talking about, and they will take it every day of the week. Not every player on your tour, not every athlete under your umbrella is going to be a great guy or is going to be perceived to be a good guy in the sport. And that's okay. We've talked about this all the time. Sports needs heroes and villains. It really does. It needs the guy riding in on the white horse, and it also needs, you know, the black knight, so to speak, where, you know, everybody wants to boo. And some players embrace that. Most don't, but there are some out there who go, okay, that's fine. If I can make a bunch of money off of this, I'm good with that.
I wonder if Bryson does like it or not. He seems like a curious guy. He seems like maybe he doesn't care. Maybe he's just like, I'm just going to go do me, and it wins me major tournaments. Of course, he's the defending U.S. Open champion, so maybe he's just like that. And I agree with you. I think it is great for golf. The Twitter beef that they had going on when the match 4.0 was announced with Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers, I thought that was wonderful for golf. People are talking about them. People are going to tune in and watch. I just wonder if the PGA itself liked it, only in terms of they like to be a little like, let's just not have anything too controversial out there in terms of newsworthy. But for just the game itself, I personally think it adds to the storylines. And, you know, they wanted that for how long? After Tiger went away, they needed something to gravitate the fans back to. And I think this does do that.
I don't think we'd ever hear it from Adam Silver, but I think he liked what he saw last night in Kawhi Leonard and the Clippers getting back into that series and maybe keeping some star power in his postseason tournament. He flexed last night. He flexed on the Utah Jazz. 31 points and maybe the nastiest dunk we have seen in months, Karen. That thing was ridiculous.
That was like, Kawhi, I'm going to go to the net. No one is going to stop me. I'm taking off from here and I'm going to throw it down. It had some vitriol behind it. It had some, this is going to make a statement slam dunk.
Absolutely. And there's a difference. Like, you can get way above the rim and you can do some acrobatics in the air and your dunk can be an awe moment for everybody because of that. But there's this type of dunk that comes with exactly what you talk about. It comes with an attitude. And Kawhi Leonard dunked with an attitude last night. And that attitude was present when he was blocking shots above the rim at his own end. Big game for him. Playoff P, as he's dubbed himself, came to play last night as well. He put in 31. It wasn't in the same manner. It didn't have the same attitude behind it. All of a sudden, the Clippers, are they the favorite in the series? They don't have home court advantage, but they have taken care of business in each of these last two games. They've got the pedigree as far as their star power, certainly in the form of Kawhi Leonard. Are they suddenly the favorite in that series, Karen?
I mean, it's tough. The home team's won so far in every game in that series. Kawhi, he did jam his knee, it looked like, at one point in the fourth quarter. He stayed in, but was definitely favoring it. So is that an issue to look at down the stretch? And if he's not healthy, I mean, then obviously the Jazz are the favorite. I would probably suggest that I'd put it slightly towards LA, but I need to see someone win on someone else's home court right now. Donovan Mitchell was great as always last night, but he did go through stretches where he is silent, so that's key for them. I don't know where you stand on this, Scott, but I do think in terms of what the NBA wants, yeah, they want Kawhi, they want the Clippers winning this series.
Yes.
With the Lakers out of it and with LeBron out of it, You want the star power of Kawhi and the story behind it all.
And we'll talk about this a little later when it gets to notes and quotes. They want Brooklyn going through as well. With all due respect to Giannis, and I know you can sell the star power of Giannis if you want, but you get the New York market, despite it being the second team. You get the potential for the big three getting healthy again. Yeah, they want KD to throw a team on its back tonight. Very quickly, just before we get to what they're saying, what did you make of the Sixers blowing an 18-point lead? Like, blowing an 18-point lead sounds a lot different in today's game than it did years ago, Karen, because teams go through these wild swings, and it's not as though it was an 18-point lead with 6 minutes to go, and all of a sudden it was whittled away. They were up by 13 at the break. Joel Embiid had a terrible second half. He was obviously hurt, but he's out there jacking shots anyway. He went 0-for-12 in the second half. Atlanta gets itself back into this series, yet doesn't feel like it's in the driver's seat the way the Clippers might feel like they are in their semi.
Yeah, it looks like Atlanta has to scratch and claw for everything that they're going to get in this series. And like you said, with the 18-point lead, Greg Anthony on the Clippers broadcast last night made a really good point, saying it was 15 points, I believe, the Clippers were up over the Jazz with 4 minutes left to go. And he's like, this is not like the olden days. Like, this feels like an 8-point lead just because of the fact how quick teams get up threes and how efficient teams are in shooting threes. And you've got Trae Young on one side for Atlanta, so he can definitely get them up. But I do think Philly's still in the driver's seat. It concerns me, the health of Joel Embiid. I mean, he went 0-for in the second half. If he's not putting up 30-plus points, Philly's in trouble. You pointed out, Scott, the fact that Philly's trying to go for the game-tying shot there, down three. And their second biggest star on the team is sitting on the bench. Ben Simmons wasn't even out there for the final possession. Like, does that even seem conceivable to you?
It does, because he doesn't shoot three. So I understand the technical aspect of it. Okay, a guy who does not shoot threes. Like, Ben Simmons took 10 three-pointers all year. He made three of them, which was remarkable by his standards because he doesn't even bother shooting them. Like, most games, 0-for-0, and you need a three-pointer. However, he is a star, and it does strike me as odd. It just feels weird that one of your big players isn't out there, even if he's inbounding the ball. He's your point guard, and he's not a little point guard. He's a big point guard.
Yeah, so he's your best passer on the team, so he would probably be the one you'd want inbounding the ball. For me, it stuck out as, okay, I know there's not a lot of time left, but would Atlanta look to foul Ben Simmons and do like a hack-a-shack, a hack-a-Ben, put him to the free throw line? Because he's terrible at free throw shooting as well. We've seen him miss key ones down the stretch in multiple times this playoff. So was that a situation for Doc Rivers? And he's been asked about this before, Doc. Like, he said in the past, like, have you ever considered not having Ben out there? Because, I mean, he missed two key free throws in the first series and they lost that game. And Doc's like, no, he's Ben Simmons. He's one of our best players. Of course we're going to have him out there. But I do think that's kind of getting into his head a little bit right now.
Yeah, both of those series that went last night tied at two. We'll get to the one that's on the floor tonight. A lot of eyeballs going to be on that one. We'll do that in notes and quotes. Let's get to what they're saying. When they brought Kawhi Leonard to L.A., it was for one reason, and he confirmed that last night. I'm not worried about any Western Conference final. I'm here to win a title. The Clippers have never even been to a Western Conference final, so just getting past this round would mark progress. Ramona Shelburne asked about the pressure there is on this team, especially with no Lakers there, Karen, the pressure on this team to win a title this year.
In their mind, they need to win a title. I mean, you have Kawhi Leonard and Paul George, and it feels like that window is not as large as you used to think it was, right? They're both in their early 30s, which means they should be in the prime of their career, but they both have these nagging injuries. They both seem to get hurt quite a bit during the regular season. And there's also this next generation of player that's coming faster than you think, right? I mean, you know, before James Harden and Kyrie Irving got hurt, I thought, oh boy, we have another monster out there, and another monster kind of team. It looked like Brooklyn was just going to run away with things. But even the younger players like Devin Booker, I mean, you know, he's arrived. Like, these guys have got, they're here now. You know, they're in their early 20s still. Donovan Mitchell, you know, still young, but he's here. And so I think there's a sense like this, you know, how long is the window for Paul and Kawhi, you know, this super team that was constructed last summer or two summers ago? How wide is that window open? I don't know. I mean, they're still kind of, you know, figuring that out, even though, you know, these guys, but I know it's still open right now. And they've never been out of the second round as a franchise, which is unbelievable. Okay. So I think Yeah, it's championship or bust, you're right, but they got to get to a conference final to feel like they've gone someplace new with these two guys.
Can I just also throw out there, like, we've got, you know, like the young guys she was talking about that are coming up and, you know, see what Dallas does with Luka, but I'm sorry, healthy LeBron James, and if AD considers going back to Los Angeles next year in the Lakers, like, won't they be the favorite again?
Probably.
Like, this is your year.
I say probably because with NBA stars, things can change in a heartbeat depending on where they choose to sign and if a little recruiting gets done. But yeah, probably. LeBron James going back to number 6, by the way. Maybe AD wearing 23 next year.
Because of Space Jam, a movie I will not be watching, Scott.
You refuse. Someone would have to pay you to watch Space Jam 2. Is this what you're telling me?
Yes, I sadly watched Space Jam 1, and I will not be watching Space Jam 2.
There you have it. Definitive statement from Karen Sermon today on the status of her viewing of Space Jam 2. Let's talk about this match tonight. By the way, Hungary Portugal still scoreless. Well, no goals anyway. Goalless, I should say. In the 64th minute of play, Portugal's been the better side so far. Hasn't mattered in terms of what actually matters and getting a goal on the board. Canada doesn't even need to score tonight. Canada can go scoreless, draw, and move through. I think they'll look for more than that. They're playing in Greater Chicago. Beat Haiti 1-0 the other night. John Herdman took over this side a couple of years ago. He was asked what his message will be to his squad before tonight's match.
Probably not much to say. I mean, the leadership group, when we met last night, they were very clear on the pitfalls in a game like this, overconfidence, thinking the job's done, or getting too defensive and insecure about the 1-0 lead. So it's just coming back to ground zero. It's a new game. It's a moment-to-moment. When the whistle blows, we get them little details right again and come right back to the basics of that last game, which is that willingness just to fight for each other all the way through. And that's the match in the Haitian intensity, which will come. And then, you know, we're on a better field. We've, you know, picked this environment for the temperature change so we can really try and impose ourselves and bring our intensity. So, you know, I'm excited. I think these are the moments you live for as a coach, as a team. You know, your country's behind you. And God willing, it happens, you know. We take this country to the octagon, but it's going to be 90-plus minutes where this Haitian team, they'll be unrelenting.
The piling on that will occur tomorrow if Canada does not get the job done against Haiti this evening will be strong. And so it should be. This is the better squad. Expectations are high. There should be a level of confidence associated with this team. Get the job done tonight.
Just don't park the bus like Sweden did yesterday against Spain, Scott. You know what? I just want to see them play their match. I want to see them take it to Haiti. I want to see them try to score goals and not sit on this one goal aggregate lead that they have. Like, earlier today, there were reports that Haiti will be without three key players, their captain, and their starting netminder, and another player, because they had visa issues getting into the United States, so they will be not with the team, if the reports are correct, for tonight's game. That scares me a little bit, because you could be looking at it, okay, they're undermanned, you know, take them a little lightly. I just want them to go out and say, look, we need to make a statement today. Let's make a statement and win 4-0.
This Canadian contingent is about far more than one player. But the one player who gives me so much confidence, not because of his talent level, but because of what I saw last week, is Alphonso Davies. They beat Suriname 4-0, and they should have beat Suriname, and they did. He scores, he assists on a couple of goals by Jonathan David as well. And there's Davies after the match. Is he exuberant in what just occurred? Is he over the moon? Hey, we just beat Suriname 4-0. No, it was a business-like approach. This is what we are supposed to do. This is a guy who's won individual trophies. This is a guy who's won team trophies. That attitude, we took care of business. We're on to Haiti, and we're going to go take care of them. That's what gives me confidence as a Canadian fan today.
And you know what, Scott, too? Like, it reminds me of what Kawhi just said last night after the game. I don't care about the Western Conference Final. I care about getting to the NBA Finals and the title. Now, for Canada, it's about getting to the World Cup. Like, that's what John Herdman has instilled in them, and it's just one step at a time. Suriname was one step. Now the second step is Haiti. They all remember, almost all these guys played 2 years ago, Gold Cup quarterfinal 2019, where they had a two-goal lead after 28 minutes. And Haiti stormed back, and they collapsed, and Haiti scored three unanswered goals, and Canada lost in the quarterfinals. So they all remember that. They remember that Haiti can push. So I'm with you. Like, I want to go out there and see them put a statement game tonight.
Win the match. Now we're talking about something real. Now we're talking about being in the final stage of World Cup qualifying, and they won't be a favorite in that. And it's Mexico, it's the U.S., it's the big boys of CONCACAF. Let's see some matches against that. Go get the job done tonight, Canada. More on that in notes and quotes as the show goes on. We're going to turn our attention from one form of football to the other. It's back. They announced it yesterday. We've got a schedule to talk about as well. And yet that doesn't mean the CFL is without questions. There are plenty, and we'll put many of them to Marshall Ferguson next, creator and host of CF Perspective, most recently the play-by-play voice of the Ticats as well. Might still be. We're not quite sure. But they're not quite sure what's going on there in Hamilton right now. They're getting everything up to speed. He'll join us next right here on Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
Well, we knew it was going to come out today, and it kind of started to have some postings here, some postings there. Eventually, the CFL gave us the entire schedule. Some teams were updating their websites. Other teams were not. We're not going to go through the entirety of the schedule, but there's some early themes that are emerging. It's Rintoul and Sermon. Yeah. Marshall Ferguson is going to join us next. Specifically what many of us anticipated. It's going to be a Western-heavy schedule to start the year. The West is going to host the majority of the games for the first 3 weeks. In fact, Karen, there is only one game in the first 3 weeks of the CFL season that will be played on the eastern side of the country.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's in Toronto, the third week of the season. The season does start in Winnipeg. It's a rematch of the 2019 Grey Cup. Scott Hamilton and Winnipeg, that's in Winnipeg. BC opens the season on the road, back-to-back games against Saskatchewan to open the season, and then in Calgary to play game two of their season. Calgary opens their season with three games at home, and then you can go from there. There's the traditional Battle of Alberta that's going to happen in terms of the Labor Day, and then the rematch the next week as well. One of note, Winnipeg and Ottawa don't play this year, which is going to be interesting because, of course, Paul LaPolice. See, there's so many changes that happened 2 years ago or two off seasons ago that you kind of have to remind yourself. Like, Paul LaPolice is the head coach of the Ottawa Redblacks right now, and Matt Nichols is the quarterback of the Ottawa Redblacks right now. So there are some quirks out there that we're looking at, but basically what the CFL has done, and this is to be expected just based on what Jason Kenney has said in Alberta and what we're hearing out here and in Saskatchewan and Winnipeg, like, stadiums are expected to have fans sooner out west than they are in the Ontario region, Scott.
All you need to know is to look at the first 2 weeks of the season. There are three provinces that will host all of the games: Alberta, Saskatchewan, Winnipeg. Playing home games the first 2 weeks of the season. That makes a lot of sense. Lower population numbers for one. Certainly outside of Manitoba, things have gone relatively well recently, and obviously things are on the up and up in Manitoba, getting a lot better in recent days as well. I don't think it's surprising whatsoever. We see at least a consistency here early in the season. There has to be, from the league's perspective, hey, Calgary opens with three straight at home, for example. I'm sure they'd like to have a few more home games at the end. But there's this willingness of, hey, whatever we got to do to get back on the field, we didn't play for an entire year. There's guys who thought they were playing next year and have since retired. They're not playing football anymore. There are coaches who never coached a game for their respective franchise. There are quarterbacks who never played a game for the franchise they signed with last year. Now they're on to another roster. Like, this is what has happened. You talked about, wow, I'm going to have to figure out who's where. Yeah, I'll bet there's a lot of dudes on rosters who are going to have to figure out who's on their team.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, we were talking yesterday, Scott, who's the head coach of the Edmonton Elks again? Scott Milinovich was hired, but then he left. And we're like, oh yeah, Jamie Ellison got promoted to that. Like, there's just, it's, and this is why the CFL had to play this year. Like, it had to stay top of mind. And you can see by the scheduling, they also understand they need to be places where they can get bums in seats sooner so they can have some revenue coming in. So that means Calgary plays three home games to start the year, so be it. If Edmonton plays three home games to start the year, so be it. Because they need to get that revenue stream flowing again. Because, and we'll talk about this with Marshall Ferguson, like, there are teams in this league that operate in a deficit in a normal year, like pre-pandemic. So I'm guessing there's some teams that probably, you know, were questionable on if it was even worth it to play this year just because of the deficit they're going to still face in terms of getting back on the field this season. So I think the CFL recognizes that, and they're doing everything that they can to get some money into these owners' pockets.
Marshall Ferguson, creator of Canadian Football Perspective. You can follow him on Twitter at @TSN_Marsh. Play-by-play voice of the Hamilton Ticats joining us here today. Marsh, it's been too long, my friend. How are you?
I agree. I was nice to listen into you guys here off the top, Scott and Karen. It's been way too long since we've connected. But then again, I'm usually just talking to you about CFL. It's been way the hell too long since we've had CFL. So it makes a lot of sense that we haven't talked in a while.
To you, what is the most other than the obvious, hey, there's going to be a Canadian Football League this year, what's the most optimistic aspect of what's emerged over the last couple of days to you?
I think just the positive momentum and also the fact that we haven't heard the words XFL, right? And not that I'm completely against the XFL. I think that there's some positives that could come out of that, and I don't even know what it looks like. None of us do at this point. But it's the idea that the league is coming back and it's not saying, yeah, but we're going to be doing it this way. It's a half season and it's because of finances. Or, yeah, but we're doing it without Toronto or Montreal. Or, yeah, there's no yeah, but. It's just Randy Ambrosi came out and said, we're playing a season. We're beginning August 5th. We're going to have a Grey Cup in Hamilton. End. Like, and then I think that's the thing that I most enjoyed about yesterday specifically was that they didn't come out and put all these caveats on it and say, well, we're still not really through. And yeah, of course, it's going to be some challenges. You're going to have to go through players behaving themselves and staying in team bubbles and quarantines and training camps. And it's a long training camp, and asking CFL guys to stay in one spot at one time for a long time is not always the most successful thing. But if you can get that accomplished, then, yeah, you can get this season off the ground and you can return back to stadiums. And if vaccinations keep going up, then you can get people back into the stands to watch these games and make a little bit of money. So, to me, it's the positive momentum of having the season, but it's the fact that there weren't a lot of these qualifiers put on the season. It was just, we're back. We're having a season. Yeah, it's not the full season that we'd like. We didn't start on time. That was out of our control. But everything that's in our control, we've done our very best. And I think that that's really positive.
Yes, and yet fans of this league do not always react that way. As much as they love it, schedule comes out, announcements come out, and it's a little bit of yeah, but. Okay, this is great, mm-hmm. but. And there'll be some saying, there's a missed opportunity here to try out a conference format or maybe expand the playoffs, see what that looks like, and generate more revenue. Is there any of that that you're seeing right now, or is it just, hey, we're living through a pandemic, I'm just happy the league is back. Whatever form that takes, so be it.
Yeah, I absolutely think that there's some missed opportunities and people will harp on those. But by and large, what I've seen so far is people saying, I don't care if you guys play on the moon. Like, as long as you're playing, then that makes me happy. I think if you're a true CFL fan, that's probably where you're coming at it from. With that being said, I think the discussion point that Karen was mentioning off the top there about the finances, the structure, the way that the different teams communicate with each other, you know, the old rhetoric that I remember hearing from my earliest days of covering the CFL was that it's not a league of nine teams. It's nine different teams that happen to play in one league, right? And there's a massive difference between those two things. It's really nine individual markets run in nine different ways. And sure, they share some best common practices, but there's a lot of very different approaches to what it means to own, operate, and distribute your product in each of these nine markets. And when I look at this, I think, yeah, they could have gone ahead and done just the one big conference. They could have gone with an 18 playoff format, which they still have the ability to expand to, by the way, which will be interesting if and when they do end up making that decision. But the idea that you're going to end up having these teams get back on the field and play, once they get to that point and they're in front of people, I think that a lot of the naysayers that are saying, well, we could have done X, Y, or Z, are probably going to fade to the background because the game itself will take over and that will be the main storyline. And again, that's usually the case, right? Whether we like it or not, all the things that surround the games, any sport, as soon as we get back out onto the court, ice, field, whatever it might be, the game, the storylines tend to take over unless the storyline is so big that it can't be ignored. And I really do think that's going to hold true this year. Once you get back out there and you give yourself an opportunity to actually have football headlines and great performances that people are talking about for the first time in nearly 2 years, where people aren't talking about the health of the game, the future of the game, the finances of the game, I think that that's going to be refreshing to a lot of people, myself included, because I'll be honest, guys, I started covering Canadian football because I played Canadian football, and I love Canadian football on the field. All the other stuff that surrounds it, I get it, I discuss it, it's part of it. It's not why I got into it. I don't think any of us get into this because we love talking about finances and backroom deals. We love talking about the games, and without having them out there on the field, it's been really difficult to talk about those things.
What's your biggest questions next? Like next step that you were to see what you need to see happen? Like, because I see logistically, like getting players up here, when they need to get up here, and you mentioned quarantining these players, and do they have more bubbles like BC does when they go to Kamloops for their training camps? Like, what's your biggest question marks?
Yeah, again, similar to the idea of nine teams operating in nine different ways, I saw that the Hamilton Tiger Cats, where I am, are going to end up having themselves basically a team bubble at a local hotel. They're not going to be at McMaster University this year for training camp. They're going to end up staying down at Tim Hortons Field. But it's a long training camp too, right, Karen? Like, it's 21 days, and you guys know from being in around the BC Lions that usually a training camp in the CFL is a joke. It's like 7, 8, maybe 9, 10 on-field practices. None of your real true starters and your stars play in the preseason. So you end up just getting yourself basically your legs freshened up a little bit and you go. But this year they're doing essentially a 21-day training camp with no preseason games. But here's the thing that's my biggest question is they're not allowed to go full contact. Like, that's in the CBA that in practices they really can't. I mean, they can go shells, they can go thud, which – for people that don't know the terminology, it's basically you're allowed to wrap up, but you don't bring anybody to the ground, and you're not popping too much, and you're not leaning in and trying to complete tackles. So when we watch week one in the CFL, that's the first time they've really tried to. Now, I'm not saying they're not going to be hitting dummies and stuff, but, I mean, we all know hitting a dummy is different than trying to make a tackle on Brandon Banks, who's all of 5'7", 175, and can dance people all over the field. So when I think about the biggest question, it's what's that going to look like in week one? Like, how comfortable are linemen going to be really getting into it again after, yeah, smashing some bags around, but that's not realistic. It's, you know, I love Formula One, and I love when I hear Lewis Hamilton, somebody asked him a couple weeks ago, do you go into the simulator very often? He said, no. He said, do you do the track walk the day before the race? He said, no. Why don't you do any of these things? Because it's not the race. Like, it's, I'm not going to learn anything from walking the track when I have to drive it at 290 kilometers an hour. So that's the same idea for these guys. When they get back out on the field in week one, they're going 300 kph down the straight. So there's really no sense in going through the motions, but we have to in order to get their bodies back into football condition. But you really can't truly do that until they start the season. And I think you're going to see the first couple of weeks might start slow, might be some ups and downs in terms of quality of play, but by week three, week four, I think things will straighten themselves out. But that's definitely my biggest question right now.
So two things come to mind when I hear you talk about that was the NFL season last year and all the soft tissue injuries that we saw early on in the year. And not to say if that's because of, you know, lack of spring camps and lack of preseasons, but there could be an argument to that. Also the fact too, and I saw this out there, I can't remember who said it, but thinking about the fact that American, like the US has been a lot more open through the pandemic and open more recently than even in Canada. Like, I don't think in Manitoba gyms are even open right now. So like players can't train. How are they training? So that strikes me as a bit of a competitive disadvantage for say Canadian athletes trying to make the team. I know there's certain roster spots that Canadians have to fill, but I just look at some of the injuries that could be coming out of this situation just based on lack of training in camp and lack of training leading up to camp.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that goes into that as well, because it's just, it's a Molotov cocktail, this training camp, because there's so many different things we've never dealt with before. And one of them I find really intriguing here, Karen, is that you've got 2 years worth of CFL draft class. So whether it's guys that are living, training down in the United States, maybe they're NCAA guys, or maybe they're Canadians who travel down south to go to a training academy if they were allowed to cross the border for all the right reasons. And now you've got essentially two classes coming in. Now there's a lot of futures draft picks that were taken in 2021, which just means guys that are going back to school, and everyone knew they were going back to school when they selected them, and they did it intentionally because there's no point in taking 50 trying to get them all into one camp because you can't keep all those guys. So the guys that do come into training camp, though, you're double stacked. I mean, anybody who has gone into two classes of a graduating class or two classes of, you know, getting your driver's education or something like that, it's a really full room. And I think on top of all the soft tissue injuries, it's going to be a war of attrition and, honestly, survival of the fittest, which lends itself to the guys who have had access to trainers, massage therapists, everything that you need, which we know has been restricted during COVID at various times on both sides of the border. But the U.S. has had it better off for a while now, so those guys absolutely have an advantage. And the Canadian players that are already in that double-stacked group, a lot of them don't have access to those things, so they're showing up a little bit raw. And I'm a little bit fearful that it might be a bit of a bloodbath in terms of the soft tissue stuff that you speak of that the NFL went through. My hope is that the coaches and the training staffs are responsible with it, and they really slowly ramp it up, because I really do think these guys need some time to get the wheels turning again.
Marshall Ferguson of CF Perspective joining us here on Rintoul and Sermon today. You love the game. I love the game. We all know great athletes, great product, not always effectively marketed. The business of the CFL has not been conducted effectively for a lot of reasons over the years. To the best of your knowledge, how much collaboration has there been among teams with the league in this offseason, which has gone on a really long time, about a cohesive marketing approach moving forward?
I think the biggest thing that jumped out to me during the pandemic as a whole was when I heard Randy Ambrosi say, and some people might not like this, right? Because you are always thinking to yourself, well, why don't they do this during a normal year? But realistically, the business of the Canadian Football League, the year-round operation that it's become now in behind the scenes with the football operations department, trying to get things like the combine and the draft and starting to look at CFL 2.0 and international players coming in and scouting those players and talking to teams about traveling to different locations to go and see players, whether it be from Mexico in the Ligue de Football Americano or if it's over in Europe, or there's all these different things where it's really hard to pump the brakes and assess how you're actually doing business. And at one point, Ambrosi said that they have actually taken a step back and reassessed every single piece of their business model. Now, there's a lot of people who know business a lot better than me who will say, that's BS, that hasn't actually happened, because they will actually read into the books or look into the numbers. But from what he said, which I take a little bit at face value on this, but at the same time, it is the commissioner, and he is, you know, it was a 1-1 sit down that I had with him, and he said, we looked at a lot of inefficiencies that we had, and not just financially, like the way that we were using people, the way that we were structuring our league office. They've decided that they had to make some cutbacks in those spots, which is a natural part of when you're reassessing. For the teams themselves, I think there's been a bit of that peel back as well. There's also been some rehiring as of late, which is important, because that really showed to me that the league was getting ready to ramp up and release a schedule and confirm a return to play date as they did yesterday and today. So I think there has been some discussion amongst the teams. They're always, I think, in conversation. The Board of Governor meetings that they've been having are important, but really it's the people on the ground, not the owners and the people that are at the top of the hierarchy, that are the ones that are making those decisions about how organizations are going to be designed. And they've absolutely been in collaboration. They've been talking throughout this, and it's not, hey, what do you guys do that we can steal? Or why are you better than us on the field? Or why is your business department more successful? It's just everybody putting their cards on the table and saying, how can we all do this a little bit smarter? And I do think from some of the people I've talked to that that's been at play. Now, some teams are more receptive than others, right? Some teams are saying, well, we don't want to share all of our secrets. And some teams are saying, well, we need all the help we can get. Some teams, like, you know, Montreal struggled financially for a long time. They've got new ownership. Maybe they've got their own ideas and they don't want to copy or try to replicate anybody else. So there's a lot of different approaches to this. Again, that's really the spirit of the Canadian Football League. And when all those different approaches come together and we get a really good on-field product, that's kind of the weird magic of the CFL, because it probably shouldn't happen the way that it does, but we get lucky a lot of the time with some really good football from a lot of different people trying it different ways.
There are a lot of people who thought this was it for the league if they didn't get back on the field, and it's a pretty fair premise. That said, while this is short-term optimism, does it lead you more to be more optimistic about a CFL and what that looks like beyond 2021?
Yeah, I don't know what the CFL-XFL relationship is going to look like. I mean, you could go anything from full merger all the way down to having a playoff game at the end of the year, which for me personally, the Grey Cup is the greatest thing that exists in Canadian football, right alongside the Vanier Cup. And the idea of all of those players winning the Grey Cup, going home, partying like crazy, and then 2 weeks later having to play some team from Birmingham, I'm not crazy about. I don't think that a lot of Canadian football fans would get super excited about that. But in terms of the actual league itself and not just one-off games, it does give me optimism. And the reason that it gives me optimism is there's a lot of people that believe in the product that they are putting on the field. They know that they've got good players. They know they've got talented coaches. They know they have a history to be able to build off of, and they know that they are going to try to innovate, change things up, become more efficient. That positive momentum is real. Now, the challenge is making sure that you act on all the things you learned during the pandemic when you actually had that chance to pump the brakes and assess, because if you don't, you're not going to get another chance to pump the brakes for a long time probably. And it might be the last chance you get to pump the brakes and actually take a look around and see what you can do better. And if they don't learn from it, it could be a bad sign for the future. But I do think that there are a lot of smart people in that league office, and they will put the work in, now to try and use what they've learned, because, man, they talk to everybody. Like, the league office, some of the, whether it be the NFL, otherwise, different teams down south, the NCAA, conferences in the States. I mean, it's, they were looking around and saying, football is football, it's football, no matter where you are. We play different styles, we have different roster constructs, but how can we make this better for everybody involved? And they've talked to them. Now it's a matter of whether or not they get a chance to act on it, Scotty, which, as you know, is always the main challenge. And I hope that they get a chance to, because they're going to get up and running, and I'd like to see it come to fruition.
Yeah, it all comes back to what you said off the top. Nine teams working collectively instead of, oh, yeah, that sounds really good, but we're going to do our own thing here and operating in silos. 2011 Vanier Cup, BC play, still remains one of the greatest football games I have ever witnessed. McMaster over Laval in overtime. You were part of it.
Your boy was one for one on a fake punt pass, and then I quickly ran to the sideline and grabbed my clipboard.
It was a great game. Honestly, that game, anyone who was there, anybody who watched it knows it had everything football has to offer, offensively, defensively, special teams-wise. I know I'm speaking to a biased interviewee here, but I tell anybody who will listen that just how fantastic that game was to watch.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think at some point I'm going to get everybody from both sides, because I've become strangely friendly with some of the guys from Laval that were on that team as well, and we're going to sit down and we're going to do something big and memorable with it. It is the 10-year anniversary this year, and we've been talking around Mac about what we can possibly do, and it's basically been boiled down to a golf tournament at this point, but we'll do something proper down the road and try to remember how incredible that afternoon, that evening was.
Some great hires by your good buddy Steph Potasik here recently as well. Maybe we'll talk about that another day. Thanks for doing this, Marsh. Really appreciate it, buddy. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
talk to you soon.
That is Marshall Ferguson, Canadian Football Perspective, play-by-play voice of the Hamilton Ticats. I think he'll be the play-by-play voice of the Hamilton Ticats moving forward. I didn't want to put him on the spot there because I don't think he knows for certain he's the most recent voice. As you are well aware, Karen, there were some stations across this country that had rights to CFL properties that no longer exist. One of those stations was in Hamilton. They do not obviously have the play-by-play rights, or maybe they do, or maybe it's going to be streaming. I would think Marsh is going to be back calling games for the Ticats, especially in a Grey Cup year. They got to have something.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott Marshall, for you, our listeners just listening to him, you and I know him both very well, and he's a CFL Canadian football nerd in the best possible way. I mean that completely, only in a positive way, so hopefully he does get back behind the mic. Gil, always love having him on. I did like the fact he said, like, the CFL, okay, the XFL thing got leaked, obviously, and that was talked about, and we'll see if that actually comes to anything. But I do like the fact they talked to the NFL, they talked to teams south of the border, they talked to the NCAA. Like, are there things that they can steal in terms of promoting the game up here?
Well, there are, Karen, but I will go back to this, and it remains the biggest challenge this league has faced, in my opinion. I've been around it a long time. The nine teams need to work together.
Yes.
There needs to be revenue sharing. It needs to be, well, it doesn't matter if it's the best thing for us this week, it's the best thing for the league. And teams have operated so independently in this league for so long that it's a really tough corner for some franchises to turn. And if you're a have in this league, and there aren't a lot of them, you might not want to share with the have-nots. But if you want a strong league and you want a viable future, you better find a way to do it, or else it's not going to work. And if they can't do that, it's really tough. As much as I have loved the game over the years, and as much as I have loved the league over the years, it's very tough to see a future that goes beyond the next couple of years or next few seasons. And I want that to exist. By the way, if people could have seen our facial expressions during that interview, it wasn't necessarily to Marshall's answers. It was to everything unfolding before us in this Hungary-Portugal match, because we're listening to Marshall, but we've got our eyes respectively at our own homes right now, watching what turns out to be a 3-0
yes.
victory for Portugal. The drama in the late stages is off the charts.
Hungary went from thinking that they had a 1-0 lead, they scored a goal, looked to be good, called offside, to then Portugal going back down the pitch, scoring three goals, including two from Cristiano Ronaldo. Scott, he only needed one to become the all-time leading scorer in Euro history. He is now the all-time leading scorer in Euro history by two goals. He has 11 for his career. He passed Michael Platini with 10. Age does not seem to be a factor with him, but I feel really bad for Hungary. They deserved a better result than that.
I believe it was the correct call, and Portugal was the better side on the day, but Hungary was hanging tough. I believe the offside call is correct. I do not think they got this wrong, but you're right. Hungary, the play continued, score a goal, up 1-0. Not so much, and then you know just because you've watched sports long enough that it's going to go back the other way. And it did, and it's a deflection off their own defender. It's not an own goal, but it's a deflection off the defender on the shot. Ronaldo then gets what was a deserved penalty. It wasn't on him, but Hungary concedes a penalty. He buries that 2-0. He scores a late one 3-0, which makes it look a lot worse than it actually was. What might have been for the underdog, the heavy underdog in this game today.
And same thing too, Scott, in the terms of goals for and against do mean something in this tournament. So obviously Portugal wanted to pile it on. Hungary, they just couldn't stop the wave that came in terms of Portugal. So yes, the Portuguese, our good friend Trevor Martins is very happy this morning. Our other good friend Dominic Schermati is not. Of course, him of Hungarian descent. And Portugal, top of the table for now. France, Germany, group of death, coming up in that same group at 12 o'clock noon Pacific time and 1 o'clock Mountain time.
Yeah, just over an hour. We'll keep you apprised as to what happens in the first half of that game, as we will still be on the air, of course. We've had some good submissions earlier in the show, and we'll get to them next. We posed the question early. What's the biggest splash the Seattle Kraken could make? Not will make, but could make. What is it? What's the big name? Is it Jack Eichel? Is it Rod Brind'Amour? Is it an offer sheet? We had some really good contributions for you. We will get to that and much, much more next on Rintoul and Sermon.